Hi and welcome to Better Off Read, episode 7, in which I speak to Jordan Hart, a writer from Seattle, about Virginia Woolf's The Waves. The conversation seems to be kind of neatly framed by the waves, the idea of different voices, the idea of, different forms of expression, different ways of telling a story. So yeah, it was a great conversation. This was recorded over Skype, so it may sound a little bit kind of, it's a bit sketchy in places, but it was pretty incredible really. Like, I mean, considering that I was sitting in Wellington and Jordan was sitting in Seattle, it was pretty amazing, I think. It's just been Christmas here this week. We had a very booky Christmas. I got a copy of Creamy Psychology, which is the sort of companion book to the Yvonne Todd retrospective, which is on at the Wellington Art Gallery at the moment, which I highly recommend. Brent got a copy of Dylan Horrocks's Magic Pen, which he's been devouring. Tallulah got a copy of Northern Lights by Philip Pullman, which I am so enjoying reading to her. Man, that is one heck of a book. So there we go. That'll be us. I hope you enjoy it, and yeah, thanks. Oh, sorry, extra introductory bit. Oh, I totally forgot something very, very important. Jordan is here in January. January 24th to the 25th. Jordan's teaching this quite amazing workshop called Culture, Landscape and Creating Characters. It's happens in Kapiti. And the information's on the blog post, and you can also find out information about it by googling Kahini and Jordan Hart's name. It's going to be an amazing workshop, and part of the kaupapa for that workshop is sort of talking a little bit about how to tell the stories of people whose perhaps experience is different from our own, and what stories we have the right to tell and what stories we have the responsibility to tell. So we talk a little bit about that. So come along, check out the website. Woohoo! Yeah, sorry. Can you hear Comedy Bang Bang in the background? Brent's listening to Comedy Bang Bang. I feel like I can hear it. Whoa, meta podcast. Anyway, here's the podcast. Thank you, bye. There you go. Okay, so welcome to Better Off Read, everyone. I'm Pip Adam. I'm here with Jordan Hart. Hi, Jordan.
Hello.
He's all the way over in Seattle. I'm sitting in a rather murky, it's supposed to be summer, but it's not very summer. Is it raining there, Jordan?
It is raining here. It's pouring, actually.
Oh, it's raining. That's what the weather's like at the moment. It's raining in Wellington and it's raining in Seattle. There you go.
Yeah.
Bizarre. Anyway, today Jordan and I are going to talk about The Waves by Virginia Woolf, I came across it because I have a very good friend called Helen Lerndorf, who's a poet and a prose writer, and she writes essay as well. And she often talks about this book, and I didn't read it, and then I read Mrs. Dalloway and had a lot of trouble with that. And I think a lot of the reason I didn't read it was I had this kind of idea of the persona of Virginia Woolf, and yeah, I had trouble with it. And then last year, it was only about 3 or 4 months ago, I picked it up. I loved it. And I read it, like just devoured it. It took me a long time to read. It's like one of those skinny books that takes a long time. But I really, really enjoyed it. How did you come across it, Jordan?
I came across Virginia Woolf, well, in school first.
Yeah.
I mean, we read a lot of the short stories. We read Kew Gardens and we read A New Dress and just short pieces. I didn't get to her novels until I was in graduate school. I was traveling in Arizona and I'd been reading a book. I think it was The Wizard of Oz, and it fell apart on me. I was looking for a new book. So I was in Flagstaff, Arizona in a used bookstore looking for something that would, like, you know how books jump off the shelves
yeah.
when you're ready to read that particular yeah. book? And I had seen all of Virginia Woolf's novels before, but had kind of steered clear of them. I didn't think I was quite ready for them. And for whatever reason, that moment in that time, I found Mrs. Dalloway. And it was $2. And I started reading it standing on the sidewalk in you know, it was 120 degree heat or something, so it'd be like 50 Celsius or something. I'm standing on the sidewalk reading this book, and next thing I know, I'm eight pages into it, and I'm in this world.
Yeah.
And since then, I've not been able to get enough of her.
Yeah.
Of her work.
So what do you think? It's really interesting, that idea of being in the world, because, I mean, that's, I felt like Mrs. Dalloway was like that. You know, like, it is, I mean, there's lots been written about sort of the technical idea of the book and all that sort of thing. But there's something about the feeling, though, isn't there? Like, I guess you can't really quantify that, you know, if you were a literary critic or something. But do you feel like that? Like, there's something about the feeling of the book.
Yeah, well, you know, it's different than her other books I've read, I believe. So I, you know, I'd read To the Lighthouse actually before this one, and had really enjoyed it. But there was something about Mrs. Dalloway that pulled me deep inside it, whereas with To the Lighthouse, I always felt like I was reading it through a window, or I was reading it through a piece of ice, where I could appreciate it and I could marvel at it. I've taught it. I'm talking about To the Lighthouse here. I've read it aloud several times. But there was never a moment where I felt like I was inside the heart of To the Lighthouse. Whereas when I picked up Mrs. Dalloway, I felt like there was a warmth that sort of enveloped me. I was Septimus Smith. I was Peter Walsh. I was Clarissa Dalloway. You know, and talking about technique, I don't know what the difference is, because To the Lighthouse is written in a very similar way. Stream of consciousness techniques, you know, the natural world blending in with the inner world and vice versa. And so I'm not sure what the difference is. And maybe it was reading it in Arizona, where it's so hot that it felt warm. But I've read it several times since, and every time I, you know, every time I enter it, it's still the same for me.
Yeah, because I totally agree. Like, the that's what I find so interesting about her now, that I've finally sort of got over the, I don't know, like, I just can't put my finger on what it was about her. I think it was that, you know, like, maybe at school all the brainy girls read her. I don't know, but I don't know what it was. But yeah, like, but now that I look at her sort of work, each book seems to be played with a different instrument. Like, not, I totally agree, like, the craft is the same, but there's something about the tone. I don't even have the right words for it, but there's something very different about each of them.
Yeah.
And like Mrs.
I feel the same.
Yeah, and like, I think with Mrs. Dalloway, I never finished it, and I'll talk about, I will segue into that later, but I think with that, there's something about London and the modern, there's just something that seems like that, very obviously because it's one day, but there's something very instantaneous about it, that, and I think that idea of immediacy rather than looking through a window, it's it's just so good. But To the Waves, so which order does that, where does that sit in her books that she's written?
Well, you know, in terms of her chronology?
Yeah, just the chronology,
It's the second to last one that she wrote. And the interesting thing is, she didn't publish another novel after The Waves until The Years, which was 6 years later, which is the longest gap. And you know, usually she would do a novel every 2 to 3 years. After she wrote The Waves, the next one didn't come out until 1937, and then that was her last novel.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about The Years is that it isn't, I love the way you talk about it as a different instrument. The Years is entirely different from The Waves. It's like she reverts to just writing a standard contemporary, you know, sort of traditional novel, even though it takes place in many different years. It's written the way most writers write prose, as opposed to The Waves, which is, you know, sort of a play, poem, series of soliloquies. Which, that's interesting to me. You know, that gap is interesting to me, and also the reversion to sort of the more traditional way of writing is really interesting to me.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm always interested in this idea. Like, I guess, I always think of that French movement, I can't remember what they're called, but, you know, they have this idea that for each book they have to reinvent the machinery, you know, like each, you know, like, you know, like, this book needs a different language kind of thing. And I do wonder, like, when I think about The Waves, I think, you know, and compared with The Years, The Waves does a lot. What am I trying? It asks a lot of the reader, I think. I don't know. I don't think that's, I don't, yet it doesn't in some ways, because if you just let go, what it is the simplest conversation you can have in a book. You know, she said, he said, da da da. And, but it asks a lot. And I'm just wondering, with asking a lot, what does it give? You know, like why, I just always wonder why that story is written that way.
You know, it took me years to read. Like you were talking about not finishing Mrs. Dalloway. It took me three different reads to actually finish it. The first time I tried to read it, I got through, I think it was Bernard talking, and I just thought, there's nothing to hold on to, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
The next time I read it, I got a little bit farther, and then I put it away for a few years. I read a lot of her other work, and you know, it's she does ask a lot of the reader. I think she respects the reader in a way that is very uncommon in writers. When you were talking about earlier not finishing Mrs. Dalloway, I've never finished Ulysses by James Joyce. I've tried to read it, I don't even know how many times, and every time I try to read Ulysses, I get less as far as I have the time before. So now I just pick it up, read a few words. I'm like, okay, that's good. I've read Ulysses for this year. But what I think Virginia Woolf does differently than what James Joyce does, and I love Dubliners. I love the artist. I love his work.
Me too.
But I feel like she respects the reader even a lot more, which is weird to say because of how many historical allusions and puns and myth Joyce is bringing into it. But with Woolf, I feel like it's a very human book. It's a very human style of writing. You don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to know a lot about Irish or British mythology or whatever it is. You don't have to bring anything to it. I love the way you're talking about you just have to let go. You kind of have to surrender yourself to what she's trying to do and be willing to go with her on that journey in a way.
Yeah, because I think it just occurred to me when you were talking that what it does seem to want to do is get, and I guess, you know, like, I guess you could argue the same thing for Joyce, but what it does seem to want to do is get to the heart of the experience, if you know what I mean. Like, it seems to want to communicate, and it seems to have found this way of communicating. And yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I'm quite obsessed with the idea of difficult books. I'm putting difficult in inverted commas, but no one can see that. You know, and I think, you know, I remember someone saying that to me about Infinite Jest once. They were like, it's not a difficult book, it's just a long book, you know, and it has long sentences. And I think that's what I felt like with The Waves. I was kind of like, this feels difficult, but then, yeah, like what it seems to want to ring, it seems to want to get rid of the artifice of plot and time and you know, a lot of those things, so that we strip those away, so that we're at somewhere different. I don't know because I totally agree. The book took me a long time to read, and there were lots of times where I thought I was done. And I think one of the things that really helped me with it was there was this recurring motif which I in my head is a sea animal's fin cutting the surface of the water. But that may not be the motif. That may not be the motif. I maybe just have made that up. But this idea of the waves rolling in and the sea, I found that really interesting. But I also, you know, it's that weird thing of sort of placing it into the context of the characters and stuff like that. And I just wonder, what do you think about this idea of the place of the sea in the book? That's a weird question.
Interesting thing. For me, the sticking point when I first entered the waves is the fact that when you find your, so there's six, you know, as you know, there's six different consciousnesses. We're inside six different people at various times, and it repeats over and over who we're within. The way that she signifies the consciousness that we're in is with they said. So Bernard said, or Susan said, or, you know, Ginny said. And so for a while that was hard for me to get used to, because I was looking at it, you know, who are they talking to? Are they talking to me? Are they talking to each other? Are they standing sort of on stage and having sort of a Shakespearean soliloquy, a monologue? You know, and I wasn't sure if they were speaking these words aloud. And they were really advanced concepts that they're speaking aloud. I mean, when the novel starts, they're children. They're waking up. They're about to go to school. And I'm thinking, you know, these are Shakespearean actors delivering almost like Alexander Pope, the Rape of the Lock monologues at their window instead of going to school. So that was a sticking point for me until I realized if I accept that, if I just accept that the signifier is going to be, Neville said, and then accept that once I get that signifier, then I'm in his consciousness, then I can just go with it. Once I accepted that, I loved the way that she was able to seamlessly, blend one consciousness to another, how, plot gets stripped away, artifice gets stripped away, and it just cuts to the essential nature of six different people living their really complicated oil and water lives. Mm. And yet at the end, you realize there was a plot, that there was a lot going on, that it was a very human story, told in this amazing way. Mm. None of that answers your question, and I apologize. The waves, what I love about the, because she's using almost sort of these two metaphors, is the waves come crashing in, and it feels to me like the swelling of the wave is them living, and then when it crashes on the shore, that's sort of the final scene. That's the last line, and it's done. And then with the sun, tracing the arc of one day, so a life being one day, which is really similar to what she does with Mrs. Dalloway.
Yeah.
The entire action takes place in one day.
Mm.
She sort of takes one day to mean one lifetime, so it's still this sort of complex narrative arc, but very simple at the same time.
Mm.
And I do love how she goes from sun and waves, really simple, really elemental, to their specifics of their lives, then back again, back to the specifics, back to the elemental, in this really kind of way that once I got through the first, however long it took, 10 pages maybe, then it was like, okay, you take a deep breath, you let go. I had to read it in really short spans too, because of the richness of the language.
Yeah, me too. And I think the two things, I really like that idea, that difficulty of the, Neville said, blah, blah, said, because I know, I get that, I was in a class a couple of weeks ago and we were talking about first person narrative, and I was saying how with any narrative, even if it's third person eye of God, I still personify it, and I still have this thing of where are they standing? Right. What are they doing? Is this in their head while they're doing other stuff? And I think that what was interesting about this, because I had the same problem. I was kind of like, ooh, I don't like this. This feels a bit, it feels a bit theatrical. I don't know. I was very, and I was kind of like, ooh, it's a bit old fashioned. That was my first thought. But now I have completely revisited that. And I think that actually it's really quite modern, well, quite contemporary, because it, like you say, putting that tiny little bit up the top just says you're reading a book, it's artificial, this is who's speaking, crunk, we'll get rid of that, and we just get rid of that in the first thing. Kind of, and I so much like it better than the idea of having a section headed Neville and a section headed Ginny. I don't know, there's something so strange about this idea that it's spoken. And I guess that's where the poem play idea comes in, doesn't it? Because it does feel verbal and it does feel spoken in a way, like that first scene with the kids. Because the language, I don't know. The really language,
Because, when we watch a play, we accept the fact that there are, we accept the artificiality of the stage, and we accept the fact that someone will come to the front of the stage and say something like, to be or not to be, and we don't think it weird because we're prepared for it. And I think, like you're saying, we have to accept that this is not necessarily a novel, that this is sort of a poem-y play, a play-y poem, and that the characters will speak their inner minds to us. I think the reason I prefer Mrs. Dalloway to the waves is because Wolfe does the exact same thing, but in a way that I feel like is more organic to the piece, and it blends in.
There's this scene in
Mrs. Dalloway where Peter Walsh, he's returned to London, he's kind of walking around thinking about how things have changed, how it's all different now, and the girls are not as modest and men are saying things, typical kind of things that maybe he would think. But instead of Peter Walsh said, she would write Peter Walsh asked himself, or Peter Walsh thought. So you get, a paragraph or two or three paragraphs of his inner mind, his inner consciousness, and then she'll just throw in Walsh thought or Walsh believed. And it's so invisible that you for me as a reader, I'm more in his mind. I'm more in Clarissa Dalloway's mind.
Yeah.
In a way that I'm always aware in the waves. I'm always slightly aware that it's a performance piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so while I'm still experiencing Bernard and I'm experiencing the pain, you know, when Percival dies or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just a different way that she's creating it. Really, really interesting to me.
Because I think that's why, I think this is why the Waves did it for me in a way that possibly Mrs. Dalloway didn't. Because I felt like the Waves did feel kind of postmodern in that sort of performance way that I felt that I was, you know, I was distanced and I was, you know, these extremely human, horrific things. These really, you know, the horror of life kind of stuff. I know maybe I'm being overdramatic, but, you know, those kind of things were happening. But there was this weird distancing. And I think sort of like, what's the word? Like, I think sort of intuitively or emotionally, that's kind of more my read than the other. But which comes first? Sorry, I am hopeless with chronology of biography.
Oh, that's right. Mrs. Dalloway is chronologically is before The Waves.
Yeah, which is so interesting, eh? So that totally, because I was thinking maybe Dalloway's a development of The Waves, but it sounds like, you know, it sounds like this weird thing where it, you know, who knows which, you know, I mean, you never know which was written first, I suppose, but, you know, it's quite, it's really interesting, the idea that, yeah, that she was willing, like she had performed some beautiful thing in Dalloway, but was willing to sort of, you know, make it slightly different, you know, make it slightly grungier, kind of dirtier, and, you know, like, and more, like you say, more performative in there. That's really interesting. You were talking about the idea of one day, and that was one of the things that I found exceptionally interesting in The Waves, was the way that time moves. Like, I was just so, I think this is what made me fall in love with the book, was there's a scene where a time 20 years, I don't know, like there's different times and they're butted up against each other. So the book just seems to have that. I went and saw Interstellar last night. I'm all about the time at the moment, but there just seems to be this weird thing where time kind of butts up against each other. Like, it feels, it's really weird how I was never confused about whether we were pre-Percival, post-Percival. You know, like I had this idea that I could sort of place the time of the piece, yet there aren't a lot of time. Am I right? There doesn't seem to be a lot of time sort of management stuff in the text.
It's very, I mean, it's, you know, when she says where the sun is, you know, we immediately know, okay, so it's morning, so they're children. It's noon, so they're, you know, mid-adult. It's sunset, so they're, it's brilliant. I mean, I love everything she's doing with it. And then you get to see, too, you know, them. You know, one of the things that I always go back to in terms of character, and I feel like these six and seven, if you include Percival, but these six characters are so rich and so complicated and so detailed, is what Harold Bloom said about Shakespeare, which is that Shakespeare's characters don't unfold to the reader. They develop themselves. So it's not that there's a mystery waiting to be found. The characters are constantly changing and dynamic. And they overhear themselves say something, and that changes them. And I feel like Wolf's characters do the exact same thing.
Yeah, totally.
You know, the love affair between, you know, Lewis and Rhonda, et cetera, or Rhoda, that changes them. That changes how she sees life. That changes how he sees life. Mm. You can see them pulling back a little bit. You can see them scarring. Mm. You can see them embracing new parts of life as they move through, you know, this day, I guess, in the sort of biblical sense, I guess, the one day. But I love what she's doing with character in a way that I think is even beyond maybe what she was doing in her earlier work.
Yeah, because I'm talking about character. One of the things that I love, and you alluded to it, is this idea that Percival is there. He doesn't get a monologue, does he?
No.
Yeah, and I just, this amazing idea, because I'm always interested in this idea that a book is kind of, that a character is kind of built in the negative, kind of, you know, like people talk about him and that builds him rather than, you know, rather than him being, and the fact that he dies is that wonderful thing that you get, that bizarre, you know, like he's absent, so of course he's not there. I don't know, which also brings that interesting thing about from what point in time the the characters begin their monologue? You know, like, are they beginning them as children and carrying on, or is this being told from a later point post Percival?
Right,
That,
right,
yeah,
right.
it's quite weird. But that character of Percival, like, that is part of that. If the story had a plot, is that possibly, is it his life that drags it through? Like, is that what's giving us like a spine through the middle so that we can find our way through as well, in a way? Or is that silly? That might not be right.
Because like you're saying, we never see him from the inside. We never experience Percival's consciousness. We only experience Percival as experienced by, you know, Bernard, by Ginny, by Neville, by Susan, from the exterior. In a way that, you know, Faulkner, when he wrote As I Lay Dying, the character of Jewel, who was sort of this dark, grungy, kind of dirtier character, we experience everyone else's consciousness in As I Lay Dying, Darl, Vardaman, we experience everyone. We never experience Jewel. It's only told, you know, about him through what other people are thinking. And I see the same thing with Percival. He represents to different people different things. You know, to Neville, he represents the something he could never have. To Bernard, he represents sort of the perfection that he could never have. And so that's, I love the way that he's used in the book. It's less about his inner life and more how his life affects everyone else. There's that really uncomfortable scene where he's in India. And, you know, there's a wagon that is not able to move. So Percival, sort of the great white hope, jumps out and helps move it. And the text is really uncomfortable in terms of how it's written, in terms of, you know, British versus native. And that's that moment where I'm like, right, this was a certain era. You know, I think we elevate Wolfe to such a high level that every now and then you still realize that in some ways, you know, she was still a product of her time and place. But even that perspective is also filtered through Bernard's consciousness. Yeah. So we're like, maybe that's not Wolf's perspective. Maybe that's what she's giving, Bernard. You know, Bernard, in a way that then sheds light again on not only these six characters, but where do they find themselves in terms of not just the one day, but in terms of where Britain was in the colonial history of our planet, which is fascinating to me, how we get to see that as an added layer to the internal dramas that she's talking about.
Because you see, this is exactly where I found myself with Mrs. Dalloway. And I can't even remember. I mean, I'm probably misreading it completely, but I just found that the book had this kind of, oh man, I'm so going to say it the wrong way, but I remember ringing a friend and saying, oh my goodness, Wolf's a bit of a snob, isn't she? Like, I just had this idea that, you know, like, working people got these odd, you know, like their language was weird and the same as the India stuff in the waves. And I mean, that's why I kind of wanted to talk to you. I think I said to you just before, like, in New Zealand, we often have this conversation about what stories we have the right to tell, and you know, like, cornered onto that, which I think we don't have enough of a conversation about, is what stories are our responsibility to tell. But I'm just thinking, like, I really, and the workshop's coming up next month, which I think there are heaps of people really looking forward to it here, this idea that, you know, how do we write characters that are from different cultural or geographical backgrounds? And I was just wondering, like, what do you think about that? Like, should Wolf have just, you know, she shouldn't have written about working class people because she wasn't a working class person, or, you know, what do you think about that kind of thing?
Well, it's, you know, I always go back to the quotation by Toni Morrison, who I think is the greatest American novelist we've ever produced. She is the one that I would say this is, you know, what great work looks like. She did a lot of work on 19th century and 20th century American literature, looking at Mark Twain, Ernest Hemingway, Faulkner, you know, Poe, Hawthorne, Alcott, Dickinson, a lot of these writers, and has written a tremendous body of work kind of exploring kind of the progression of how Americans write one another, how we tell one another stories. And what she said primarily was that a lot of white writers, a lot of white American writers, went to great lengths to erase black lives from their books. So you could read, you know, an entire novel by Hawthorne, say, or someone else, and you would never even notice, you would never even know that there were black people living in the United States at that time. And Morrison's quote that I always go back to is that she said, it takes a lot of effort to erase someone from history. It's not something that can be done lightly. You have to put in a lot of time to erase people from your work. So for someone to write a book that is completely in their culture, in their limited maybe scope, there's a lot of work that they have to do to shut everything else out, so they can kind of put blinders on. So for Wolf to include, you know, working class, to include the people who actually were living in England at the time, to me as a reader, you know, trying to read it through Morrison's lens, what that says to me is she was aware of the full spectrum of her society, and she tried to write the way she saw her society in a way that I, as a reader, respect, at the same time understanding kind of, you know, where those limitations were, where she maybe didn't get it correctly. And I would agree with you that there are some cringe-inducing moments in Mrs. Dalloway as well, again filtered through Peter Walsh's consciousness, so we see the world the way he sees it. You know, the classic novel I go back to in this vein is Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The N-word is used 219 times in that novel. And it's, you know, the way that different characters speak, the way different characters speak about other people, there are moments where you're just, you cannot read it until you remember that this is how folks in Missouri talked in 1880. That Twain was simply transcribing exactly what he heard. And if it's difficult for us as readers to read, that's a good thing, because he's taking the truth, he's putting it between two covers. And he's forcing us to read it. He's forcing us to hear the N-word. He's forcing us to see the things that we've, you know, maybe we block out, maybe we try to erase, maybe we don't want to go to those places. And he makes us go to those places in a really interesting way.
I think that's what, there's a lot of talk in New Zealand at the moment about privilege, you know, like, and who gets a voice to talk, and how we talk and what we say, and and I think that these are conversations that we tend, I find it really interesting here, because we tend not to have them, you know, we tend not to talk about it. We tend to continue to rely on certain people in our society to write certain books, and we'll write other books, and, you know, everything's cool, and everybody, nobody, you know, upset anybody. But I guess this is one of the risks, isn't it? That if you do write other culture, I really like that quote from Morrison, because I think that's so true. Like, I've read a couple of New Zealand books lately, and I've just thought, oh wow, there are no Māori, there are no Pacifica, there are no, you know, there's no, we have quite a few people coming here from Malaysia, from China, you know, and so there's none of that. But in the same vein, I often read books and I think, oh my goodness, everyone's straight in this book, or, you know, like, it's really interesting, because that idea, it's kind of blown my mind a little bit, because this idea of erasing and kind of, it's a strange, strange thing, isn't it? It's a really odd thing. It's
one of the other things that I think we're, you know, we talk about here, you know, it's the difference between cultural appropriation and trying to take someone else's story and tell it, which immediately, you know, people aren't going to read that, versus understanding the role that other people play in your own story, maybe a different class plays in your own story, and being able to tell that in an authentic way. Attempting to tell someone else's story is a non-starter, but being able to tell your story in a way that doesn't erase other stories from your experience, sometimes I think is what artists do, is a way that artists can hold up a mirror to society.
Because that is the interesting thing. Like, recently, an Australian writer won the Booker Prize, and I heard an interview with him where he was talking about bearing witness. He was sort of saying that, you know, that this is the job of the writer, you know, we are here to bear witness to the time that we're in. And I just think about that Twain book and Faulkner, and, you know, and to a certain degree, you know, there are other writers, even more contemporary, who have sort of, you know, I often think of James Kelman, who's a Scottish writer, who's a socialist, and, you know, this idea that, yeah, sometimes it's the hard thing to write. Like, sometimes it's a lot easier. There's a slight obsession here at the moment with historical fiction, which I think is great. You know, it's fantastic. And there's that odd thing about revisiting history here. But I think also there are some really good books being written that do that thing where they bear witness to the time that we're in. And yeah, and I think that idea of a mirror to society, it's not, yeah, I don't know, it's interesting. I don't know. Ah, these are huge things. I like talking about them though. They're really good. I keep thinking about, there's a piece of your work which I just read this morning, which is online, which is called Leap. I'm trying to think where it is. Oh, I haven't got my computer on. But can you remember that piece off the top of your head?
Uh-huh.
That's just recently been published, eh?
Yeah, I think it came out last year, if I'm remembering.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just thinking about, like, I mean, that is such a wonderful piece. I really, really love it,
oh,
for starters.
Well,
and I also think, like, I think that demonstrates the things that you're talking about, because it does seem to, it kind of holds this mirror, but like you say, it's not appropriating a story, which I think is really interesting. And do you remember the process that you went through to write that? Like, is that a story that just came to you? I'm calling it a story, but I don't know. How do you call it? What do you call a piece like that?
Yeah, I have never been able to come up with a word. Whatever you call it, I will go along.
That's great. But, oh, sorry, you go.
No, so that piece came about. My grandfather was a fisheries biologist who tracked the lives of salmon. So he tracked sort of the migration of salmon from their birth, then the way that they live is they go up through Alaska, they feed in the deeper ocean, they come back down the Alaska coast, then they come back into Puget Sound, they go up the creeks that they spawned in, and they die in the exact gravel bed that they birthed.
Wow.
So it's this 9,000 mile journey that they take during the course of their lives. And what he would do was tag the salmon as they were leaving, and then when they came back, they would be able to try to identify, you know, where did the salmon go. And he was one of the people who helped track, you know, the migratory routes and find out where they start, where they go. And so this is kind of what I grew up with, being around biologists and people in the fishing industry and all of this. And I was really interested in telling the story of a salmon. And at the same time, I had this image in my mind of a woman in a trailer park. And in my mind, over time, the two stories became the same story, sort of one being a metaphor for the other. Mm. That was the process to write it. And then one day I just sat down and went into a trance state, and I don't even remember the writing process itself. And then I revised it for the next 5 years, it felt like, until it felt like it was done. But you know, the interesting thing for me is I'm sort of interested in humans, but I'm also kind of not. I mean, I'm more interested in, I think, in natural rhythms, in plants and animals, in kind of how life goes on before humans were here and will continue to go on, hopefully, after humans are gone. Mm. And to be able to tell the great natural stories through the lens of something we can address easily, which is a human, is kind of where that came from.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Like, I mean, that really ties into what I'm working on at the moment, because I'm really interested in this, you know, I'm particularly interested in this hierarchy of, there's a really cutting quote from, who's it from? I can't remember who's it from, but they're talking about Rudyard Kipling, and they're sort of saying, you know, he should have been, you know, like, he should have been our Balzac. You know, he started with people, and then he went to machines, and then, for God's sake, he went to animals. You know, like, it was just this weird hierarchy that, you know, like this idea that some things have more worth in a story than others. And yeah. I'm really interested. That's what I think I really attached to Leap, was this idea that, you know, there can be a dual story about experience. And yeah, I love what you said about the idea of nature after us, you know, that it feels so ripe at the moment and just so interesting. I love it. It's blooming exciting. The other thing about Leap, I'll put a link to it, is that it is structured. Did the structure come late in the piece, or did the structure come early in the piece? Like, when you first had that first kind of creative sort of like outpouring, did it structure itself differently on the page, or can you remember anything about that?
In our when we do open mics in our coffee houses here, when we get together, there's sort of a Pacific Northeast cadence that people use. It's I don't know where it comes from. I don't know if it's like sort of the rhythm of the rain that we're so used to, but we tend to kind of talk when we're reciting our poetry here, we tend to kind of find this rhythm, and I'm not really sure how to explain it. But so I started, whenever I start to write, I start as though I'm actually reciting it, mm-hmm. As if I'm speaking it. And so the punctuation and the layout on the page doesn't really come into my head, because they're just notes for me for when I perform it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the way Leap looks on the page is only so that I can grab it from the page when I'm reading it out loud.
Wow.
And I read from my phone a lot now, this sort of modern 2014 world we live in.
Yeah.
And some people don't like that, but it's like, why print it out on new paper that I'm just going to recycle? Why not just, So there's this whole other conversation about, is that too? Whatever. But so I read from my phone a lot. So I need to have it laid out in such a way that I can access it and find what I'm looking for. So the structure is designed for me to be able to perform it, as opposed to be written, to be read on the page more than anything.
Mm. Because that's what I found really interesting, like when I read it, is that there's that thing, I was talking to students about this last week as well, this idea of how much direction we give the reader. And I was thinking that really helped me to take breaths and to, it did feel like musical notation. I just think it's really interesting. This idea of reading.
That's a great way to think of it. I've never thought of it that. Yeah, it's like a notation to be performed, as opposed to be. That's a great. I'm gonna use that. Thank you.
Yeah, use that. this idea of reading aloud. This idea of breath. I don't know. It feels very body centered. This idea of reading aloud, and I love the idea that you guys are reading aloud so often out there. Do you see that as a part of your creative process, the act of reading to an audience? Does it become like, do you read the energy of the audience as you're reading? Are you aware of any feedback from the audience, or is it more, I'm thinking about comedians now, how do they, but
100%. So every audience is different. Some people are drunk, some people are not, some people are looking to laugh, some people are looking to cry, some people want to laugh, but secretly they want to cry.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it is you get up on stage and you're looking around and kind of taking the temperature of the room and then figuring out, A, what the group wants, but then B, does the group actually want something else? And so trying to figure out, and it's totally pandering sometimes, and I own that and I admit that. I've got humorous pieces I can pull out. I've got serious pieces I can pull out. A lot of times the audience likes to go on a journey from humor into depth and feeling something deep and then come out again on the other side. And it's like every time there's an audience, we have such a responsibility to them, because they're giving up a half hour, an hour of their lives. And so to get up there and sort of mechanically produce, here's what I've prepared, it feels like it's kind of missing the point. I think we try to elevate our audience in such a way to say, you guys are giving up an hour of your extremely short lives. Let me make it worth your while. Let me give you something that is worth it. That is worth you being here.
Yeah. And I just love this idea. I don't know. Like, I'm really interested in alternative ways of publication at the moment. Like, I'm really interested in how we what's the word I'm looking for? Like, give our work to other people, because I guess that's what I think of publication like. And I think the reading is such an interesting, because it's completely, it won't exist the minute you've said it's finished, kind of thing.
Yet it
lives in the mind. Like, I think about readings I've been to, and they're still living very fresh in my mind, And I just, So do you guys organize a weekly thing, or like is it a regular open mic kind of thing, or how what sort of readings going on in Seattle at the moment and in your kind of community?
Well, it's so rich right now because there are so many different kinds of readings that are being organized. So, you know, if one were inclined, one could go to something probably 4 to 5 nights a week.
Oh, fantastic.
I mean, and that's a lot. And a lot of them are different. So for example, there's a cafe here called Traditions, and you know the kind of thing you're going to get because the organizers tend to pick they have the same kind of thing that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one called the Old Growth Poetry Collective. You mm-hmm. kind of know what you're going to get when you go there.
Mm.
There's one called the Gray Skies Reading Series. You kind of know what you're going to get when you go there. And it's different constituencies, different audiences. There's a little bit of overlap, so you'll see some of the same people at different ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then generally different performers, different writers, different storytellers draw different people.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's and there are so many genres that people write in, and so many different places that people are going, that I think people can find what they're looking for. Mm. It's somewhere.
And so you're teaching at the moment as well as writing, eh?
Right. Yes.
So where do you teach there?
I teach at a college called Peninsula College,
mm-hmm.
And it's mostly literature and creative writing,
mm-hmm.
Which is great. I mean, it's reading, it's writing, it's talking about reading, it's talking about writing, and then mm-hmm. they pay you for it. And I'm like, you guys know that this is amazing, right? That this is heaven.
I totally know what you mean.
I mean,
I totally know what you mean. Every now and then I just have to pinch myself.
You paid me to read this book? This is amazing.
This is great. And now we're going to talk for an hour about all the interesting problems there are in writing a book. That's great. No, it's fantastic.
Right. Yes.
And you also work with Kahini. Do you want to talk a little bit about, because Kahini's quite new here.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how it started and, you know, like sort of some of the ideas behind it?
Sure. So Kahini, one of the things that I started doing in 2008 was I would run this thing called the Port Townsend Writers Conference, which would bring about 200 writers together for a week every summer and talk about writing.
Awesome.
And it was really great. And it's this sort of intentional community that arises, and people are able to just deconnect from their lives and connect with their artistic work, connect with each other, and have really deep conversations through artistic work. What I noticed, though, was that it was drawing from the exact same kind of pool. So it would be writers from Seattle, Bellingham, Portland, Olympia every year. It would
mm-hmm.
be all the same people coming every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do a lot of outreach to bring in new voices. We'd fly people from different parts of the country, but the financial cost was, you know, a lot. And there are a lot of obstacles to doing that. And so we thought, wouldn't it be great if, instead of it just being us having a great time every year with one another, what if we could also connect with people from various parts of the world and all be having the same conversations and meet other people and kind of step out of the box? So we reached out to – so we called it Kahini. We started reaching out to different other groups of writers. So we started doing programs in Eastern Washington, which is about 200 miles away from Seattle. And then we started going a little further afield, finding other writing organizers who were doing interesting things in their communities, and then trying to figure out ways to exchange writers from one place to another. So what we've done so far is we're still kind of building the infrastructure.
Mm.
To be able to, the ultimate goal is to be able to have writers be financially supported to be able to exchange from one place to another. So right now we're working on bringing writers from Kampala and Kigali to the Port Townsend Writers Conference next summer.
Awesome.
We're working on doing festivals in various places around the world,
mm-hmm.
Just so that we can hear one another's stories, so that we can share wine together, we can have food together, we can laugh together,
mm.
And how that can enrich our own lives, how that can enrich our writing, what we can learn from one another, and, you know, what books people are reading. There's a ton of interesting work that's happening.
Yeah.
You know, that I really want more people to be able to read and to be able to experience. And so that's kind of the purpose of Kahini. It's to get writers in the same room from many different geographical, social backgrounds, economic backgrounds, and then tell one another stories so that we can, you know, write more more well-rounded pieces.
Mm. That just sounds, it sounds so exciting, and I love the way, like, I mean, in a couple of the biographies that I read of you, that this idea of, I don't know, I really get excited by it, like this idea of a writing life, you know, of writing feeding life and life feeding writing, and reading feeding life and life feeding reading, you know. And I just think it really is, yeah, because I think I think that it's quite a sort of modern idea for me as well, you know, like it feels exciting, because I know when I was, I'm quite old, but when I was like 14 or 15, I had this idea that writers were people who shunned the world, sat in an attic,
the ivory tower,
like wear black, you know, like smoke and drink, you know, like have these very closed lives. And there was a really interesting, oh gosh, I can't remember where, I'm full of things I can't remember, but Damien Wilkins, who's a teacher here, and a fantastic writer, he was talking about this idea that you often see writers thanking their family for, you know, like the books that they've just read, and they often say, I'd like to thank you for the time that you've given me, giving this idea that they've kept the family away kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he was talking about how you grow emotionally in a family, you know, like, and I was just thinking how my writing's picked up since I've had my daughter, since I've had responsibilities in my community.
Yeah.
And I just find, I just think that it feels quite different to me than this idea of the artist kind of alone and, you know, like, go away everyone, you know, like I need to be brilliant. And I really do feel like that my writing is fed by the community that I'm surrounded by. But yeah, that was a rant.
Writers, we spend so much time alone already to create the work, that to be able to talk with one another as we're going on this journey, to be able to share, you know, here's where I'm having a hard time, here's what I feel like I'm struggling with, here's areas, you know, I think the more that we can support one another on this journey, you know, results in the kind of work. But the other thing that I love is I feel like literature, more than anything else, more than a painting, more than a movie, you know, more than even maybe any other art form, I feel like literature allows us to be able to step fully into the self of somebody else fully experience being, you know, not just what things look like, but, you know, when I'm in the mind of another person in a book, I can feel what the rain feels like to them, and I can feel like what things smell like to them. And when I'm done with the book, when I'm done with the piece, I now see someone else with more empathy, with more understanding. And in addition to enjoying the world they're creating, I think I make better decisions as a reader because I understand other people and other people's decisions a lot more. And then when I write, I share my writing with someone else. They can step into what it's like to be me. Even if it's fiction, because even if we're making things up, we're always striving for emotional truthfulness and accuracy. And so sometimes to read literary fiction, you know, when I read War and Peace, I can step into the mind of a Russian noble as Napoleon is invading Russia. Even though Napoleon is invading them, they still see France as sort of the ideal, sort of the culmination of all that is good. And they're trying to speak French at the Russian court because they sort of elevate French culture. And I can read that, and then I can appreciate kind of what that must have been like, why certain decisions were made, how that led to the world that we're in today. But I can see it with more empathy. I can see it with more understanding. And I just think it makes us better people.
Oh, I totally agree. I really agree. And I think, you know, yeah, I just totally agree. I'm just thinking of the books that I've read this year and how they do kind of project me different, not project me, they kind of, when I walk out into the world, I love what you said about that, like when I walk out there, I do see things differently. Like I really, what I love most is literature that sort of like absolutely resists generalization, you know what I mean? Like where it talks about specific experience. And what seems so odd is that when it talks about specific experience, that seems to hit me millions of, you know, often sort of hundreds of years, often hundreds of years, or, you know, like a different country, you know, especially living in New Zealand, you know, like we're really isolated down here. Like we're not, I mean, you know, we have a lot of input from things, but it really is interesting. Like when I was in the States, we did a trip a year ago or so ago, and we were sort of on the west coast and a little bit, but we were reading Grapes of Wrath while we were traveling around, and I was just thinking, I started reading it before I got there, and it was just so great to sort of have that experience in one way, kind of the literary experience, and then to live it, and you realize that, yeah, like it's okay for me not to have to go to Russia, not for me to have to go to South America, not for, you know, like I can get some of that from the books that I'm reading, I guess. I don't know. Oh God, that another rant. Oh, I'm a rantaholic. You're making me rant.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there's no way for either of us ever to live in the 1930s. I mean, you and I will never be able to directly experience what it would be like to have your entire farm disappear, to have dust in the sky, to have nothing. Mm. And so when we read Grapes of Wrath, all of a sudden we're like, oh, that's what, I mean, we are the Jode family. We are Rosa Sharn. We are the people that it's happening to.
Yeah.
I love it because, I mean, that's what literature is. It's where we can experience something and we can have that experience even though we never had that experience.
Yeah. And you see, that was this odd thing as well that I really loved, was the fact that it seems so relevant. Like, as we were traveling through, watching just, you know, these huge strip malls and, you know, like just this idea that, you know, and it's happening here as well, this idea that we've gone down to like one crop here pretty much, which is cows. Right. Basically, we farm cows here, you know, and it's kind of like just this idea that corporations, and I don't know, like it was just incredible that, you know, it was talking about a specific time that I'm not in, specific people that I'm not, yet it opened my eyes to things that are happening right now. It's really incredible. Hey, I think we're just about out of time. Which is sad. What didn't I get to talk to? Oh, I think I talked to you about almost everything. But I really like how the way the conversation started with the waves, this kind of weird oral versus, you know, strangely formatted, odd thing about the experience of other people. And it kind of ended up talking about, poetry readings and prose readings. And yeah, I think we did good.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Hey, thank you so much. Thanks heaps.